Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies. My name is Kelly McFall from Newman University, and I'm a host on the show. And today I'm thrilled to talk with Michael Guerin about his terrific new book, Comrades Betrayed, Jewish World War I Veterans Under Hitler, published by Cornell. Mike earned his doctorate at Clark University, and he's now been teaching at West Point for several years. And his book is a fascinating study of the experiences and responses of Jewish veterans in the period 1919 to 1945. It's full of quotes and anecdotes and stories and excerpts from a seemingly never-ending stack of diaries, letters, and journals. But it's also deeply informed by gender studies and military history and Holocaust studies. And it's a superb example of historical excavation. I'm looking forward to talking about it with Mike. And so, Mike, thanks for joining us and welcome to New Books in Genocide Studies.
Kelly, thank you for inviting me to be here to talk about Comrades Betrayed. It's a real honor.
So I always start with the same question, which is to give the audience a chance to know a little bit about you by asking you to introduce yourself. So so tell me a little bit about what you do and why you do it.
Yeah, thanks, Kelly. Currently, I am an assistant professor of history at the United States Military Academy at West Point. I'm also deputy director of the Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies here. And this is for me. This is a good place for me to tell everybody that the views and opinions expressed by me here do not necessarily state or reflect those of the United States Military Academy. As you mentioned, I've been at West Point for a couple of years. I'm going on my fifth year here now. Prior to that, I was an adjunct professor at Boston University. And prior to that, I taught at Northeastern University as well. So I've been adjuncting at a few places before I had the fortune to come here to West Point as a postdoc. That was a temporary job that ended up becoming permanent.
So I believe the center that you assist with is relatively new. Do you want to share something with the audience about what it does and what its purpose is?
So the Center for Holocaust and Genocide Studies at West Point, it is new. It's been in existence for about 10 years now, and I'm exactly the second scholar working here. For the longest time, it was my boss, Dr. Fry, who headed the center. And what we do is we do more than just teach Holocaust and genocide studies courses. Our mission is to teach cadets about prevention. You know, we're in the business of preventing mass atrocities and genocides from occurring, or at least to reduce the risk of mass atrocity. And we do that through history, by using the examples of the past to get cadets and students and other faculty members to analyze genocide, acts of mass atrocity, and think creatively about preventing them. So that's our mission. People always ask me, it must be hard, mentally, to work in this field, reading about mass atrocity and horrific events all the time. And it certainly is. But I remind them that that we're in the business of prevention. That's what we do. And to me, that's always been inspiring.
So you've written a book about Jewish World War I veterans. And I want to acknowledge here just briefly, as listeners will probably be aware of, some of the challenges of language. And so I'll talk about Jewish veterans, recognizing that maybe some of them didn't understand their own identity as Jewish. But for convenience, we'll use that. You've written a book about Jewish veterans of the First World War. What got you interested in that project?
That's a good question, Kelly. And I've actually been interested in this topic for a long time, really since maybe even my late teenage years. I was born in Germany. I grew up in Germany. I spent about eight years living there. And even after moving to the United States, I visited my relatives and grandparents there usually every summer. And as a young teenager, I was always interested in war monuments. I would walk up and look at them. I may have been one of the only people to stop and read all the names on these monuments. And I noticed that in the town where my grandparents lived, that there were Jewish names on this war memorial. And this was a monument to the fallen of World War I. I asked my grandfather about this, and I asked other people about this, because in a way, it surprised me. Jews up to that point, this was about 30 years ago, and Jews really hadn't been written into the history of World War I, at least not yet. So this kind of caught me by surprise, and I was also really curious about their fate during the Third Reich. How could a government treat somebody who had sacrificed for the nation, who had given his life for the fatherland? Were Jewish veterans persecuted in the same way that ordinary Jews were? And what happened to them? I was just curious, and nobody seemed to know. So this is something that's always kind of been nagging at me for a very long time. When I did get into college and majored in history and did get into grad school, I realized that nobody had written on this topic yet. When I was speaking with my advisor, Thomas Kuhne, he suggested I focus on this issue because nobody had written about it. There had been no books written about Jewish veterans during the Nazi period. There were always mentioned almost in passing in many of the really good histories of the Holocaust. And there's so many of them out there, but they were largely subsumed in this greater narrative of Jewish suffering, rather than being examined very deliberately. So this interested me. And about the same time, I came across a photograph that you'll see on the cover of my book. This is a photograph of Richard Stern, who was who lived in Cologne. He was a business owner in Cologne, and he was protesting the Nazis picketing his storefront on April 1st, 1933, during the April boycott. And this is the only photograph we have of Jewish veterans using self-assertion, kind of demonstrating against these Nazi measures. And a couple of things, this photograph's on the cover of my book, the actual photos on the inside of it. And a couple of things struck me about this right away. I mean, first off, in this photograph, you see two of the most recognizable symbols in German history, the Iron Cross and the swastika. And in this case, it's almost like they're in conflict with each other, in opposition to each other. And I thought that was interesting. And here you see in the photo, you see Stern, who is a World War I veteran, a so-called Frontkämpfer. This was a German word for frontline veteran. Literally translated, it means frontline fighter. And this was an exalted status in Germany, and especially during the Third Reich. And a stormtrooper, a much younger stormtrooper, almost a pubescent stormtrooper, is standing next to him, and the tension in that photograph is—it's almost palpable. This tension here, and the power here is with Stern, with Stern. His confidence and his poise—it exemplifies his higher status, and it almost diminishes this Nazi stormtrooper who seems to be very, very uncomfortable. And so I've never seen a photograph like this where the Holocaust perpetrator is diminished like this by the victim. Those two things, just a longstanding interest in this photograph that I've looked at, we see it. I think it's become common in the last couple of years, but it really intrigued me, and I wanted to know more. And there hadn't anything been written on it. So that's where the journey began.
Yeah, the photo is striking, and so is the narrative you used to begin the introduction. So to frame the book, I wonder if you could tell listeners a little bit about who Julius Kotzmann was and why you chose his story to start your book.
Yeah, so the book starts with the story of Julius Katzmann, and he was a business owner in the town of Würzburg, which is a medium-sized town in Franconia, which is a part of Bavaria today. And he was the owner of a very successful textile business in Würzburg. Katzmann, he was an acculturated Jew. He considered himself German first and Jewish second. He considered himself a Jewish citizen of Germany. And in 1914, he volunteered to fight in World War I along with his brother. Young men at this time, he volunteered, thinking that the war would be over by Christmas and that he'd miss out on it. So he was enthusiastic about being able to serve in the army during the war. And he ended up serving 4 years on the Western Front, where he was wounded. He was awarded the Iron Cross Second Class and the Iron Cross First Class. And before the war was over, he was given a field commission. He was promoted into the officer ranks. He returned home from the war. He was highly decorated. He was a former officer. In Würzburg in 1918, it was one of the places in Germany, next to Berlin, next to Munich, next to several other towns where there was a communist insurrection. And in April 1919, the Spartacists, this was a Marxist organization, they briefly took control of the town and the town hall for about 3 days. Katzmann was one of the men who volunteered for the citizens' militia, the Einwohnerwehr, and helped to put down this communist insurrection. So these things in and of themselves, they aren't really that remarkable. Many Jews, they did volunteer to fight in World War I. Many of them came back with medals and as officers. What is remarkable is that up until 1938, until the eve of Kristallnacht, Katzmann's business was still largely intact. He had not been arrested or detained by the Gestapo at this time. In his life, he seemed to live a very, quote-unquote, normal middle-class existence up until 1938, despite Nazi intimidation, despite anti-Semitic laws that had been put into place, despite harassment and persecution. And I found this remarkable because it kind of challenged this narrative that many histories of the Holocaust follow, that this narrative of Jewish powerlessness, this story of Jews encountering a social death and being neighborless by 1935, not having friends and neighbors left and kind of being outcast in their society. This wasn't Julius Katzmann's story. His business was successful. He still had a large circle of non-Jewish friends, including several officers, Wehrmacht officers, who were garrisoned in Würzburg. This was a garrison town. So I found this remarkable in and of itself. Like many Jewish men, Katzmann, he was arrested on the night of 9 and 10 November, Kristallnacht. And he was deported to Buchenwald, along with thousands of other Jewish men. What happened, though, was really nothing short of remarkable. The employees working for his textile business, they got together and they sent a letter. They sent several letters, actually, but one of them went to the Reich Chancellery in Berlin. It was addressed to Hitler. And in this letter, they asked that Katzmann be released from custody and set free. And among the reasons they gave for that was his World War I record, the fact that he was a former officer, that he had earned an Iron Cross, he had been wounded in action. And because of this, he had, quote unquote, proven his Germanness. And this would be a phrase I would see again and again later on, this notion that serving your country, that fighting in the war would prove one's Germanness is something that says a lot about the status of the military, masculinity and service in war and national identity. But this letter was sent to the Reich Chancellery. There were other letters also sent to other government ministers. It was in his Gestapo file in Würzburg, which I was able to read. And this letter was signed by 25 of Katzmann's employees. Several of these employees were Nazi party members. At least one was also an SS member. So I have never seen anything like this before during Kristallnacht, any kind of collective action, any kind of collective response from the German public in support of a Jewish person who had been arrested. This is the only time I have seen this again. Later on, about a year later, after I was finished in Würzburg reading through Gestapo files like this one, I was at the Holocaust Museum in D.C. as a fellow. And through the International Tracing Service, I found a fragment of a memo that had been sent to Munich. And that fragment of documents, there was this letter, the same letter, had also been sent to Franz Ritter von Epp, who was the governor general of Bavaria at the time, a very high-ranking Nazi. He was also a notorious Freikorps leader. And he also received a copy of this letter. So we don't know exactly what happened next, but a day or two after these letters were received, a day or two after, there was some back and forth between Gestapo offices about what to do. Katzmann was released from Buchenwald and allowed to return home. So this was an example of a successful intervention, and it shows as an example that Jewish men, they were not powerless. They had they had the means to use the record of serving in the war, this record of military service, to overturn their status as quote unquote Jews, and exert some agency during the Third Reich.
Yeah, that's a remarkable story, and it frames many of the themes that you talk about in the book. And so let's start to unpack some of those. And you start with World War I. And I guess I'd start by asking you, is there or was there, as you were preparing this book, kind of a traditional or received historical understanding of the experience of Jewish soldiers and their responses to that experience in World War I? And how does your narrative differ from that?
Yeah, that's a really good question, Kelly. And the story I read about Jews in World War I followed a very similar trajectory, and that is that Jews volunteered en masse in 1914 to fight in the German army during World War I. Jewish community leaders they wholeheartedly supported the German war effort. Hoping to use this as a moment to overturn anti-Semitic stereotypes and to achieve equal rights in Germany. And that the narrative continues that that during the war, Jewish soldiers encountered anti-Semitism in the army. They encountered anti-Semitism in the trenches. Evidence for this being the so-called Judenzählung, the infamous Jew count. This was a census of Jewish soldiers that was carried out by military authorities in October, November of 1916, whereby all Jewish soldiers were counted in the trenches to see how many Jews occupied positions behind the lines compared to in relation to how many were actually in frontline units doing the fighting. And this was held as evidence that Jews would never be considered equal citizens in Germany. And as a result of these experiences, Jews returned home deeply shaken by these experiences in the trenches and on the home front. They were shaken by this rising anti-Semitism by German nationalists at home. So really the story I read was one of a Jewish disillusionment. World War I was kind of evidence for Jews that they would never be accepted into German society. And one that and this experience set Jews on the path to Zionism, or to wholeheartedly support the establishment of a democratic republic in 1918. And there's been a lot of research in the last couple of years. There are books by Tim Grady, for example, have pointed out that this wasn't necessarily the case. There was anti-Semitism both during the war and on the home front as well. But when we analyze the letters of Jewish soldiers, for example, we see that Jewish soldiers or in letters and sent from the field or in diaries that they had with them, that anti-Semitism was rarely mentioned. The Jew count, which had been central to scholarship on Jews during World War I, and which had been analyzed really after the war as well by Zionist activists, this was really a non-issue for many Jewish soldiers serving in the field. Far more in these letters and these ego documents from Jewish soldiers, we hear about comradeship in the trenches, about fighting for a common cause, about moments of inclusion, you know, with other Germans. And so the voices of Jewish soldiers that were very different from much of the scholarship, this narrative of disillusionment that one saw.
And so the war ends with this sense, let me back up one second. You've mentioned this ideal of a Frontkämpfer, of the community of veterans that is established in World War I. Can you talk about how, is that community one, that sense of community and that sense of set of values and that experience, is that one that's broadly shared between Jewish veterans and non-Jewish German veterans, or do they perceive this experience differently?
I think when we're talking about comradeship, I think it's important to distinguish the primary group comradeship from the war that soldiers experience in the front lines, and the comradeship after the war, the type that was experienced and cultivated by regimental associations and veterans organizations and various interest groups after the war. Very much so at the front lines. Again, if we read Jewish letters and diaries from the time, it's important to know that Jewish soldiers did encounter anti-Semitism throughout the war, and literally they encountered it everywhere. It was in the barracks. It was in the trenches. It was a fact of everyday life for Jewish soldiers, and accusations that Jewish soldiers were avoiding frontline combat. You know, this was really the main thrust behind the Jew count. You know, these allegations that Jews weren't dying in the same numbers as real Germans, right? Jews went out of their way to overturn these stereotypes, to show bravery and courage and determination in the field. And if we believe Jewish diaries and letters in that were written during this time, they were wholeheartedly accepted by their comrades and frontline units during the war. Far more than talk about anti-Semitism, Jewish ego documents talk about inclusion and serving side by side with their fellow Germans. And this primary group comradeship, it was based on contingency. It was ad hoc. It was a response to life-threatening dangers and life-threatening situations. It was a means to alleviate the stress and the hardships of the front that included the fear of dying, fear of suffering wounds and killing. And this kind of comradeship, this kind of contingency, just couldn't be replicated after the war in peacetime society. I think after the war, comradeship far more became about memories of that conflict, and it was infused with politics in many cases. And we see this kind of, you know, happening today after our withdrawal from Afghanistan, right? There's already a lot of talk about what went wrong, and different people who had served in Afghanistan kind of tend to have different views on why the U.S. Failed there, why in essence that war was lost. And you had the same thing going on in Germany. And in Germany, there was a group, there was a really there was a dichotomy there of opinions. One of them held that Germany had been stabbed in the back, that Germany really had not lost that war, that the army was undefeated, and it was the Allied material superiority that defeated Germany. It was Jews and socialists on the home front. And another group thought that it was actually the officer corps and the monarchy and the incompetence of certain generals was at fault. And those two camps, they were at odds with each other. So a lot of this unity that we see in the front lines, it did change, and in many cases it did evaporate after 1918.
You do a lot in that chapter with veterans organizations. So can you maybe sketch out a little bit what kind of veterans organizations existed nationally or locally? And what did they do? And how did Jewish veterans participate in them?
Yeah, that is a good question. And you're right. After the war, there were literally thousands of veterans organizations throughout Germany. Some of the largest ones I just referred to. One of them was mm-hmm. was the Stahlhelm, which was a right wing nationalist veterans organization, and the Stahlhelm, it was probably the most influential veterans organization during the 1920s because it really shaped a lot of nationalist discourses and memories of the war. And this was really a memory of the war that was really grounded in this notion that Germany had been betrayed, that it wasn't the army's fault that they had lost the war. It was the politicians on the home front, socialists and Jews, who had undermined Germany's war effort. This was one of the largest organizations, and it also passed an Aryan paragraph in 1924, which banned Jewish membership, which was an interesting case in and of itself. Jewish veterans, they actually formed their own organization immediately after the war, largely as a response to rising anti-Semitism, and usually as a means, as an interest group to counter these accusations that were already surfacing that Jews had been cowardly, that they had been traitors and war profiteers. This veterans organization was the Reichsbund Jüdischer Frontsoldaten, the Reich Association of World War I veterans, of Jewish frontline World War I veterans. And the interesting thing about this association is that it adopted many of the nationalist narratives that were also being propagated by the Stahlhelm. It also in its newsletters and its speeches, in its gatherings, it also pushed this narrative of the undefeated army, which was so central to the stab in the back narrative. This idea that the German army really wasn't responsible for Germany's defeat; it was Allied military superiority. It was industrialists. It was a lot of things, but the army itself was undefeated. And interestingly enough, it had at times. I mean, depending on location in Germany, and depending on the time period, it also had an ambiguous relationship with the Stahlhelm. In some towns and regions in Germany, these two organizations worked together. They attended the same reunions. They worked on the same commemoration projects. They collaborated on outings and things like that. So it was really interesting that the Jewish organization was really also adopting this very pro-German, pro-nationalist memory of World War I. One of the other big organizations was the Reichsbanner, which was a socialist veterans organization. It was actually the largest veterans organization in Nazi Germany. And the interesting thing is that the RJF, this is the Jewish Association of War Veterans, they really didn't want to be seen as being too close to the socialists, right? They I mean, if people are accusing Jews of being traitors and cowards and not being sufficiently patriotic, not being sufficiently invested in Germany's cause in World War One, you know, you don't one doesn't want to necessarily cavort with socialists. And so there is a tension between the Jewish organization and the Reichsbanner that was never entirely overcome. That was on the national level. And there were, again, as mentioned before, there were tensions between these big organizations, these nationally based organizations. On a much lower level, in small towns in Germany, you also had regimental associations. And these were unique to Germany in a number of ways, mainly because of the recruiting practices of the German military. German regiments, they recruited locally. So in Würzburg, for example, there were two regiments there that recruited from Würzburg and the small surrounding towns, meaning that everybody in that regiment was from the same area. Many of the people knew each other. They had gone to school together. They had seen each other in town. After the war, these regimental associations, they were populated, you know, again, with people who had served in the same regiment. So it wasn't unusual for two people in the same veterans group to have actually served in the same unit during the war. And on that level, relations were markedly different than on this national level. You had Jews, Christians, and Protestants all cavorting together under the banner of the old regiment, the patterns of relations were much different, and that would prevail really until the early Nazi years, where Jews were accepted. They would have synagogue services during veterans gathering when the regiment got together, alongside church services. Jews were elected as chairman of local regimental associations. And if you look at the membership of local regimental associations, you'll find that many of the members held concurrent memberships in nationalists or socialists organizations as well. It was a gathering place of a lot of different backgrounds.
So one of the really interesting parts of the book is a examination of the lens of the way in which Jewish veterans understood what it was to be a man and what masculinity meant, which of course derives to some extent from their upbringing and their families, but also is shaped by their military experience. So what does it mean to these Jewish veterans to be a man and to be a German? And are those two kind of overlapping or distinctive? Or talk to us a little bit about those kind of identities.
Yeah, also a good question, Kelly. And yes, masculinity is really central to this story. I think it's central to understanding militaries and soldiering and gender relations in the 19th and the first half of the 20th century, even today, arguably. But in Imperial Germany, starting in the late 19th centuries, late 19th century, young German men were expected to fulfill certain ideals, certain masculine ideals that were strongly identified with the image of a soldier, These bourgeois images or expectations of masculinity included stoicism and include the ability to make rational decisions, you know, of being a rational man. And this masculinity, this gave Jews a means to subvert anti-Semitic stereotypes. This is why hegemonic masculinity or normative masculinity was so important to Jewish men growing up in Imperial Germany and later on. And it's important to note that during the 19th and first half of the 20th century, German nationalists tend to portray Jews as kind of a foreign ethnic group living on German soil, an un-German minority that was living in Germany. And they accused Jews of being insufficiently patriotic, insufficiently loyal to the nation. Even more so, they accused Jewish men as being feeble, as being effeminate, of being cowardly. These were men who lacked the physical and moral qualities that were needed to really be a good citizen. And really what they were doing, they were attacking or questioning Jews' suitability to be good Germans. And even before the Nazis came to power, there are a lot of stereotypes about the physical shortcomings of Jewish men. They were portrayed as being selfish, as deceitful, as dishonorable, as unmanly, and more importantly, they were portrayed as being unwilling to risk their lives for the fatherland, right? And if we look at Nazi caricatures of Jews, and there were, we see caricatures earlier than this, but during the 1920s, as these newspapers like Der Stürmer were being released, we see that Jews in those propaganda papers were depicted more or less identically, right? They were short, they were pudgy, they were stocky, they had fat bellies, they had ungroomed beards, and these images were the antithesis of the German soldierly male, and these weren't just crude representations. I always wondered for a long time, what the point of these was. Obviously, nobody would believe that you'd find real people that resembled these caricatures. But there's a point to this, and the point was to remind the German public that Jews were unworthy of German citizenship. They were unworthy of emancipation. That they could never truly fit into German society. They could never, despite assimilation. All this talk about assimilation and enculturation, they would always be Jews. They would always be the other. This assimilation was just a facade. And so these normative masculine values, they were very attractive to Jews because it gave them a chance to kind of shake off or unburden themselves of these negative stereotypes. They were very drawn to the military, because the military, they emphasized values like courage and self-assertion and endurance. And this was a means to obliterate this negative image of a weak, unmanly Jew. One of the ways that I believe he asked me where the army fit into this, Kelly, and one of the means that a Jewish man could overturn these stereotypes was through military service. And I think in order to understand masculinity in Germany, you have to also understand the role of the army at the time. It was seen as the school of the nation, but unofficially it was also called the school of manhood because this was a place where young boys went, they were sent off and went into the army as young boys, and they returned as real men. This was a kind of a masculine rite of passage, becoming a soldier. So this was really a way for Jews to shake off and to unburden themselves of stereotypes of weakness.
So let's look at the beginning of the Nazi period and how all of this played out. And a couple of years ago, I interviewed Peter Fritsche about his book, Hitler's First 100 Days. And that book reminds us about how dramatic the events and experiences of those first few months of Nazi rule really was. So I wonder how Jewish veterans encountered and understood Nazis and Nazism in that period, just before or just after Hitler becomes chancellor.
Yeah, Kelly, I think Jewish veterans, they reacted to the Nazi takeover much like other Jewish Germans did at the time. There was a sense of disbelief that Hitler had been appointed chancellor. But if we look at the writings of war veterans during this time, there was no sense of panic. At the time, they couldn't believe that Germany would betray them. They believed that they had the backing of the German public, that they had the backing of influential conservative elites, and that they also had the backing of key institutions such as the army. Like many Jews, they didn't, or like many Germans at the time, actually, they didn't really take Hitler's rhetoric seriously. And they thought that they would be safe. And one of the reasons why they did was their experience during the Weimar Republic, their experience confronting anti-Semitic activists using their record of war service to overturn anti-Semitic stereotypes. These behaviors, these responses during the Weimar period, they led Jewish veterans to believe that they would not be betrayed by Germany, even now that the Nazis were in power. Like a lot of Germans, they thought that the Third Reich would be short-lived, that Hitler was really just a useful idiot for Hindenburg and the conservatives, and that he would not last. And they were convinced that Hindenburg, especially Hindenburg, they had a lot of faith in Hindenburg and several other prominent conservatives, that they would be a break on Hitler's radicalism. So their first response really was one of optimistic caution, I guess. And they were, they were committed to outlasting Hitler's Reich. Mm-hmm.
So the conventional narrative, and you referred to this a little bit earlier, has features then kind of walking through a series of increasingly restrictive Nazi legislation, with maybe the Nuremberg Laws being a particularly high point in that process, and talking about how Jews were identified and isolated and how their wealth and property was taken away from them. How well does that kind of conventional narrative of the 30s fit the experience of Jewish veterans?
Yeah, Kelly, this was one of the reasons why I was so fascinated about the stories I read of Julius Kutzmann, Richard Stern, and other Jewish veterans, because they seemed to defy that narrative that the Jews were powerless after 1933, that they didn't have any agency during the Holocaust. And that they had been relegated to the margins, to the fringes of German society by 1935 at the latest, with the passage of the Nuremberg Laws. And in one of the claims was that Jews had suffered a quote unquote social death by at least 1935, meaning that they had lost all their friends, they had lost their neighbors, they had become neighborless, and they had they had been kicked out of institutions and lost jobs, and they had lost all their ties and connections to their communities and to German society in general. And I found that to just not be the case. When looking at many Jewish veterans, by looking at the Gestapo files in Würzburg, for example, or in some of the police records that are still in existence there, what I learned was that many Jewish veterans were not kicked out of their job, did not lose their employment until after Kristallnacht. They remained, especially those working in private businesses or being employed. Those employed by industries, they retained their jobs, even though there were efforts by local anti-Semitic activists to get them kicked out, to get them fired. And many of their employers refused to do that. And there were many court cases where Jewish veterans successfully appealed to a court. And this is 1935, 1936. Jewish veterans went to a Nazi judge and appealed their case and won. Not all the time, but there were times when they overturned this ruling, mainly based on the fact that these had been Jews who had quote unquote proven their Germanist during the war. And so I thought this was fascinating. There were many Jewish veterans who owned businesses, and they still had loyal patrons all the way up until 1938. In terms of anti-Semitic laws, which you mentioned, there were a series of ordinances that were passed beginning in 1933 that forced Jews out of the civil service, that prevented Jews from becoming lawyers, prevented Jews from becoming doctors. And from the very beginning, Jewish veterans opposed and challenged these measures, and they found their supporter, their mouthpiece, in people like Hindenburg and other senior conservatives that were in the government and the army at the time. Hindenburg famously, as a result of the petitions and letters he was getting from Jewish veterans and from war widows, he ordered Hitler, in no uncertain terms, he ordered Hitler to exempt Jewish veterans, Jewish former soldiers, from these anti-Semitic laws that were being passed in the 1930s. Interesting thing about Hindenburg is that he was not a philo-Semite by any means. He never once intervened in Hitler's anti-Jewish policies besides this one time. It was the only time he would ever get involved in anti-Semitic legislation. He didn't seem too concerned about the injustices that were being carried out against other Jews. But when it came to veterans, he intervened and he instructed Hitler to create a veterans clause whereby veterans were exempted from these anti-Semitic measures. So that's why in the early 1930s, you see Victor Klemperer in Dresden, university professors, other professors were being dismissed. He was able to keep his job, his position as a professor, because he was a frontline veteran. And you see this all over Germany at the time. You mentioned the Nuremberg Laws, Kelly, and these are crucial as well. Hindenburg died in 1934. This was a really great moment of uncertainty for German Jews because, rightly they wondered what would happen now that the last restraints on Hitler's total power were now removed. And the Nuremberg Laws officially did away with a lot of the veterans' exemptions that you see, but nevertheless, there were still clauses that in legal loopholes that allowed Jewish veterans to remain lawyers, doctors, and in other certain professions. And as I mentioned, private businesses. This was an area where many Jewish veterans their business remained. Were intact until much later. So this narrative of social death, of powerlessness, of becoming neighborless in Nazi Germany, that was not always the case with these Jewish former soldiers.
And so to flip the question around in a sense, what is the ability of Jewish veterans to call upon that veteran's identity to protect their business or their job or their livelihoods? What can that tell us about the way in which the Nazi regime worked and the way in which the hopes and dreams of some of the Nazi leadership interacted with relationships with the army or relationships with, and I know the language here is problematic, but German veterans? What can we learn about that from this?
Yeah, Kelly, interesting question. And I think two things I think that are worth mentioning in here. And I think you had two competing narratives during the Third Reich. Number one, you had this narrative that portrayed Jews as being an internal enemy, this foreign ethnic group living in the Reich that was inherently hostile to German, this un-German German minority that had been responsible for Germany's defeat in World War I. You had this on the one hand. Then on the other hand, you had another narrative that really gave the Frontkämpfer, the frontline veteran of World War I, that placed them in an immense position of prestige during the Third Reich. The frontline veteran of World War I in Germany was somebody whose national reliability, his patriotism, these things were taken for granted. It was a high status in Germany, and at the same time, you had Jewish frontline veterans of World War I that, in many ways, were able to use this narrative, one of the narratives of to overturn anti-Semitic stereotypes of disloyalty and lack of patriotism and unmanliness. So it gave Jewish veterans a means to assert themselves in public. And self-assertion was, we see that Jewish veteran self-assertion where they were able to use the symbolic capital of the war, right? They were able to put on their medals and pieces of the uniform from World War I to identify themselves publicly as veterans and directly challenge the Nazis, Nazi ordinances and Nazi laws. And to overturn these negative anti-Semitic stereotypes that we discussed, and in doing so, it caused a lot of ambiguity and discomfort among ordinary Germans. Germans just weren't comfortable, and we know this by looking at Gestapo reports and by and police reports and other records. Germans weren't comfortable persecuting Jews who had also fought in World War I, and persecuting veterans who were war wounded or who sported an Iron Cross, who were sporting it on their civilian clothes. This caused a lot of discomfort among ordinary Germans, and it gave Jewish veterans a mean to overcome the shame, to alleviate the shame, and to kind of overcome this sense of powerlessness that other Jews were feeling at the time. And I think this says something also about the attitudes of conservatives and the attitudes of many officers during this period of the Third Reich. Conservatives and members of the officer corps, they certainly supported Nazi anti-Semitism to a certain degree. But we see here in their responses to the persecution of veterans that there were limits. They did not share this unlimited anti-Semitism of the Nazi Party. This stopped when they were talking when the target of anti-Semitic action was a Jewish veteran who had served in the same unit as them or had proven their Germanness at the front lines. And so we see this in many cases, many army officers or even, I want to call them quote unquote moderate members of the Nazi Party. Many of them would make exceptions for Jewish veterans. And ironically, you would see, during the Holocaust after 1941, as many of these same people were feverishly working to murder Jews to put the final solution into practice, at the same time they're saving certain individuals, such as war veterans, from being murdered. So this is an interesting dynamic you see going on here. And again, I think it shows the limits of anti-Semitism that Germans were willing to accept.
Yeah, so there's lots to say about the experience from the period 41 to 45, and our time is drawing a little short, so I would point listeners to the book itself. But I would ask a couple questions about that. One is, or they're related, I guess, which is how does their status as veterans shape the kind of roles they were able to adopt after Jewish veterans were deported? And how do they, Jewish veterans, see their military and combat experience relating to the challenge of living in a concentration camp or ghetto? Mm-hmm.
I think in general, when we look at the experience of Jewish veterans in camps, beginning with after Kristallnacht, where they were deported to Dachau, Buchenwald, and Sachsenhausen right after the pogrom, all the way to 1941 as Jewish World War I veterans were included in the deportations to Łódź, to the ghettos in Eastern Europe, and later Auschwitz and Theresienstadt. When reading Jewish accounts of these experiences, at first it's clear that they experienced the same brutality, that they experienced the same humiliations and deprivations as all other Jews. But But after reading a lot of these, a number of things stand out. And first is that their military experience, you know, their experience of going through basic training, of fighting in the war, of soldiering, it enabled them to adapt to the camp much easier than those Jews who had not served in the military. They weren't as intimidated by the SS guards. They're used to the military commands and the drill. They were used to living in very tight quarters and to have small bathrooms and lack of sanitation. These aren't things that really shocked them. They had endured that before, so they were certainly able to adapt to the shock of landing in the concentration camp and adapting to these realities. We also see something else here, and in a way, I think for most of or many, if not most, Jewish veterans, they saw incarceration in the camps as kind of an endurance test. And what I mean by that is that they were determined to overcome the hardships, to endure this brutality that was meted out by the SS, by the SS guards, and not to let the Nazis deprive them of their honor. And they talk about this a lot. There is a very valuable trove of documents at Harvard University. About 230 testimonies were collected in 1940 as part of an essay contest. And what makes this interesting is that many of those 230 authors of these pieces, they had been incarcerated during Kristallnacht. So their memories are relatively fresh. They still don't know about the Holocaust, about what's going to come next. But if we read those, if we read these testimonies, we see that they were determined not to let the SS deprive them of their status. They were determined to show the SS that they were real men, that they were not cowards. Again, they were overturning, attempting to obliterate these anti-Semitic stereotypes, right? And even more than that, they saw themselves as a kind of a masculine role models during their incarceration at the camp. They tended to corral the other younger Jews. And kind of stiffen their backs. They saw themselves as father figures for many of the other prisoners. And we see this in many of the accounts, you know, as veterans describe themselves. They describe themselves as being much tougher, much more adaptable to the camp than other inmates. Albert Schwerin, he wrote when he described his experience at Dachau, he said, "I've never seen so many men cry as I have at Dachau." And when he said that, interestingly enough, he wasn't talking about himself. You know, he was talking about all the other Jews, Jewish prisoners in the camp. He described himself more as an observer to this, more than a victim. And so this endurance, this not becoming a victim to the SS, again, it allowed them to alleviate the sense of powerlessness. It was really a means of redemption, of redeeming themselves. And this is a narrative, you know, this narrative of redemption. You see this from 1938 all through the Holocaust and the Nazi years.
So it's a fascinating book. I'll pull back with a couple final questions. And one of them is, and I don't know if you can find this out. I don't know if the sources are there, but do you have any guesses about how the families or the partners of Jewish veterans perceive this whole process? I don't even know what that would look like, but do you think those families experienced this process in a way which was different than the veterans themselves or different than families that did not have veterans? Do you have any speculation about that?
Kelly, yeah, that's a fascinating question, and as all of them were. And I'll say this. I used a lot of sources that were written by family members of Jewish veterans, by spouses, by girlfriends, by sisters and mothers and things like that, because A lot of times you get insights into how veterans reacted and or to certain events or thought about something. You get new insights because they reveal things that veterans themselves wouldn't necessarily talk about, right? So I remember looking at one testimony by the wife of a Jewish veteran, and she was stating that her husband was really disturbed by during the 1930s, as Hitler Youth and SA men would march through the streets singing anti-Semitic songs, that talked about, killing Jews with a knife, and that Jews were traitors to the fatherland, and that he was really, really disturbed by this, and that he would come home at night and sometimes be racked by fear. If you read the testimony of that veteran, though, he never mentions being afraid. Because, in his own words, he portrayed himself as not being intimidated by these Nazi thugs, many of them who were much too young to have ever served in the war, right? There's a tendency for Jewish veterans to denigrate the SS and Nazi party members, but they don't really talk about fear or uncertainty too much in their own testimony. So this is a valuable piece you get from reading those that we have from family members. And I don't know, it's a complicated question about spouses and wives and things like that. I will tell you that there were some there was some tension between non-veterans and veterans in the Jewish community after 1933. And one of the reasons was because Jewish veterans responded to the Nazi takeover by claiming that they had been loyal Germans during the war, that they had fought honorably, that they were willing to sacrifice for the fatherland, just as other Germans had done. And in doing so, if you kind of look at the flip side of that narrative, if you use that record of military service to claim that you should be exempt from Nazi racial laws, at the same time, non-veterans believe that it really justified the Nazi persecution of Jews who hadn't served in the army. Or hadn't served at the front line, either because they were not physically fit or they were too young. So for this reason, there was some tension there between non-veterans and veterans.
And the other broad kind of question about this, I wonder what, if any, questions or insights that working on this book has given you into broader approaches to the Holocaust or to genocide studies. Are there new questions that you are thinking about that are prompted by this book or new things that genocide scholars should pay attention to? What are the broader implications of this?
I think one of the broader implications of this is that is a centrality of masculinity here. As I mentioned again and again in the book, masculinity is really central to the story of Jewish veterans during the Holocaust. Masculinity as a resource of Jewish agency during the Holocaust, and this is an understudied topic as well, because there have been a lot of studies about gender during the Holocaust that have mainly focused on women for the most part. Many people still conflate gender with studies that only have to do with women, unfortunately, and that's certainly not the case. But masculinity in itself, I think this is an understudied area of the Holocaust. And I think in the last couple of years there has been some work done on that, but I think there's still room for a lot more of that. How Jews use that as a means to defy and resist the Nazi regime. I also think this has really led me to ponder Jewish identity in Germany, and what I mean by that is that the study shows that Jews were not always leftists or liberal or atheists or kind fathers or supporters of Jewish causes, like many studies of the Holocaust. I mean, they kind of support this narrative. This is in the background of many histories of the Holocaust, this notion that Jews were part of the conservative political milieu in Germany, I think, is also a relatively understudied topic. And there's only just very recently, there's been some work done in that area. So these are two other areas that I think, you know, this study of Jewish veterans, it gives an opening for anybody to pursue.
No, I think that's really astute. And I will point listeners to an interview I did 6 months ago, maybe, with Ed Westerman about his book Drunk on Genocide, where he's examining similar questions of masculinity, in this case, for the perpetrators. But I'm struck. I do think there has been more attention paid to this in some ways in Holocaust studies than in examinations of some other genocides. And I think that's a rich area for people to explore. But yeah, I've taken a lot of your time and you've been very generous. I thank you for that. I just have the two final questions that I always end with. First is, before the flood of grading hits me for the semester, and maybe it's too late, I don't even want to look at my desk right now, but do you have a suggestion about a book or two or a movie or something for the audience or for me, something that was meaningful for you as you were reading this and understanding, just broadly speaking, maybe the history of the topic or the history of the period, or what would you suggest that I read?
Yeah, of course, I always like suggesting books and movies, and I think I'll start with a book. I think for people interested in this topic of Jewish military service in Germany, especially military service during World War I, I highly recommend Tim Grady's book, A Deadly Legacy. And it's a book that looks at the role of German Jews during the First World War, not just in their capacity as soldiers, but as industrialists, as politicians, as leaders of interest groups, and as community members. I think it's really well written. It's one of these history books that oftentimes it has the urgency and the pace of a novel. It's this really fascinating read. It's one of these books that not just other professors are reading. So that's my book recommendation. I think for a movie, and I have to say this movie, a lot of people might not ever heard about it. It's a movie called Forbidden, and it was produced in 1984. And the star is the main role is Jürgen Prochnow. A lot of people may remember him from Das Boot. He was the commander, and he plays a German Jew, a Jewish veteran who goes into hiding in Berlin. And it's a really good movie. It was German British production, I believe. But you can watch it on YouTube, and the acting is good, and it's not sensationalized. I think as far as accuracy, it's one of the better movies out there. So give it a shot.
I will do that. I'm sure my students will be happy to hear me say that I've watched a movie instead of grading. So you've given me an excuse. And the final question, what are you working on now?
What I'm working on now, well, I'm going to preface this by saying that I have two children, a wonderful 4-year-old daughter and an 18-month-old son who's in the midst of teething right now. So I have a lot of ambition. And one of the things I'd like to work on is a study of the Freikorps during the interwar period. And the reason why I'm interested in that topic is because during my research on Jewish veterans, I saw that a lot of Jews had served in the Freikorps in the 1920s. There were a significant number of Freikorps, a Jewish Freikorps soldiers there. And again, this kind of goes against this narrative that we have of that period where Jews were really not part of that history. So this led me to look at the Freikorps more generally, and its role in later, it's, you know, the influence of these campaigns and Germany's war of annihilation during World War II. This is my ambition. I haven't gotten very far yet. But once my kids, as they grow older, I'll be able to talk about this more and more, I hope.
Well, I can tell you as the parent of two teenagers that my ambitions to be more productive when they got older have sometimes worked out and sometimes not. But as you progress on that, I hope that you'll join us again to talk about your new research. We've been listening to Michael Guerin talk about his book, Comrades Betrayed, Jewish World War I Veterans Under Hitler. I hope you'll join me next time when I talk again to Saskia Wieringa about her research about the genocide in Indonesia. But for now, Mike, thank you for being with us and have a wonderful semester.
Thank you, Kelly. You do the same. My pleasure.